Talk given Saturday morning, 4th August 1973. Let us start this morning with where we left off last night. And let us spend a few moments meditatively on the body, the meaning and significance of the body. Become well aware of it, become fully conscious of it. Remember the phrase the Buddha used to use, with clear consciousness. This is the body. First one's own body, the microcosm. Not analytically, but feel it in its wholeness. And then see that this body, the microcosm, not merely represents the macrocosm, but is actually one with it, in it. And that in consciousness one can embrace the whole totality. And then one is aware in terms of this is the body, the total body. Which holds within itself everything that is and that happens. Whether from our limited point of view we call it the pleasant or the painful, whether we call it harmony or horror, whatever is included in this body. Therefore, there is no aversion with respect to anything, any particular thing or person. There is no binding attachment with respect to any particular thing or person. Let's spend a minute or two trying to be fully aware of this. Now, if you were to practice this by yourselves, when the spirit moves and when the circumstance is favorable, you will find remarkable changes taking place in your own psyche. The conflict between acceptance and rejection, between right and wrong, good and evil, that conflict will disappear altogether. The meaning of what I have just said is precisely this, that one ceases to take sides with what we call the right or the wrong. Because those words, right, wrong, good, evil, have meanings only in the limited context. In the context of totality, there are no standards. There is the absolute is, which manifests as the becoming process, the emergence and maintenance of a cosmos of law and order, as well as the explosions of galaxies colliding, of human beings at war, of cruelty and oppression, and of love and kindness and understanding. All these things become included. It is because we are not able to take in our world with this all-embracing, inclusive awareness that we suffer so much. That is one of the root causes of our suffering. There is also the other aspect. The microcosm, one's own body, one's psychophysical organism, as we quite rightly call it, is born, it is limited, it has certain capacities only, and it can be bettered. The totality can't be bettered, but the particular manifestation can be bettered. And this is something which only up to a point lies within our power to grasp, to understand, and to control. Beyond that point, of course, the psychophysical organism gives way. The noise, the pressure of life can overcome it. If one can move away from it for the time being, one can rest and recuperate. But the rest has to be a real rest, which means essentially in the psyche, the mind. And here it is that your knowledge of these things comes to your rescue. By the word knowledge, I do not mean merely a collection of ideas and thoughts. I mean this sensitivity which has become so powerful inside and poised that when you are out of the immediate physical maelstrom, that psychical strength within you, the strength of the soul, can come into play and re-establish peace and harmony. This is yoga, a restoring to one's wholeness. Restored to wholeness, there is happiness. There is calm, and there is balance inwardly. In that state, one does not take offense at anything or anybody. One is able to absorb whatsoever comes from any circumstance or from any person in the calmness and the quiet state of the mind. One has ceased to have a viewpoint on the matter. A particular viewpoint means that it is our own self-orientation which presents the viewpoint and holds us captive in it. Consider again this body, the totality. It is the body of transcendence, of God, if you like. Can God take sides? Or does God absorb everything, contain everything within his own being? It's that containment, the total containment, which is the physical, the actual expression of divine understanding, of love, and it is the state of chastity, the utterly pure state, the body of God is always chaste whatsoever happens. And this body of God can be symbolized as earth. Earth, the mother. And this mother, earth, is the eternal virgin. Who produces, maintains, regenerates, recreates perpetually. Heaven and earth, God and the world, our own awareness, our consciousness in the deeps, and this psychophysical organism. They are the father and mother, so to say, in timeless conjugation. try and let this absolutely suffuse the whole being. For in that is some of the deep magic of yoga, the magic of creation. Of the creative activity, of the creative power. And you will find that as this suffuses your whole being, becomes part and parcel of your daily life, in the midst of storm, you will be at peace. Consider that marvelous symbolical story when Christ is awakened by the frightened disciples. Note the significance. He was asleep. He was awakened by the frightened disciples. And all he had to say was, "Peace, be still." And the raging waters subsided, and there was calm. Is not this just the sort of thing that could happen to us? Only awaken Him that is the Son of God within us. God, the all-creative, indescribable power. And the Son is the representation within our individual microcosmic being, our own body, of that which it represents, namely the macrocosm. We must try and restore this word body to its full dignity, its supreme dignity. And if you and I can do it in any measure at all, we shall know the real meaning, the actual physical meaning of the resurrection of the body. I say physical in the sense in which I defined physical yesterday, meaning natural. The natural meaning, and nature includes not merely solids, liquids and gases, but all the invisible immaterial energies. In that sense, there is the resurrection of the body. And you see what immortality means. Here and now, there constantly takes place this creative activity, this perpetual pulsation of life, other life, which we commonly call life-death, but which we should call life, other life. This continuous pulsation, which is the meaning of immortality. And in which that extraordinary miracle takes place, that it is not a continuity in time, in actual fact, but a timeless action in eternity. And the very word action implies body, body in our inclusive, deep, profound meaning. If we can sense this pulse with some intensity, we understand the meaning of chastity, of purity. What we, with our limited consciousness, in our state of ignorance, see is what we call putrefaction. But awaken to this creative pulse of life, other life, this action in eternity. And it is not putrefaction, but the transformation, the transmutative process to which we awake. And if we awake to that, psychically, we find ourselves free of this miserable captivity to attachment, aversion, attraction, repulsion. These dark, opaque obstacles obscuring that light of transcendence which constantly lives and shines through us. It is our task, our business, to let it happen that way. Therefore, start with the body, the microcosmic body. Restore it to its true dignity. The body. Embodied transcendence, that's what the body is. What will you find then? You will find beauty. When one is really taken up in that magic which is the indescribable, carefree, thought-free love, and says and thinks of the beloved as the beautiful, he is speaking and saying the truth, whatsoever the beloved may be. You are beautiful. And it is this which is the beauty in each and every one. Not that which rouses disturbing passion, something of time and decay and sorrow. But this which is the reality, the fact of eternity. Eternity is not the dream. the ephemeral fantasy. Eternity is the reality, and the changing shapes are the dreams which float past through the body of the eternal. You see how things, circumstances, situations can be changed, therefore. If this deep awareness wakens up within oneself, then that extraordinary thing happens, namely, that not only does one's own mind and feeling, one's behavior and action change into the beautiful, but in a mysterious way, circumstance changes. And it changes for the best, simply because, and perhaps almost totally because, my desire, my conceptions, my petty little feelings and so forth have not intruded upon the reality. Therefore, the shape of the circumstance changes from the distorted, the unpleasant, the painful, into the healthy. Into that which truly expresses divinity itself. The holy life, the godly life, the divine circumstance is not a particular shape which should or ought to stay put, or which I, the ordinary man, must attempt to conceive of, to picture. My ordinariness, my mediocrity will inevitably be embodied in my picture. Let transcendence function freely. And then, whatsoever is there will be eternally beautiful and right. It is a curious mystery, even in the midst of pain, the pain of the mind, there will be peace. Let us not forget the words of the Buddha. At the heart of all things lies bliss. The happy art of being blissfully lazy is not the product of indolence, but of being wide awake. What can we relate this to? particularly in the sense of the discipline of the holy life. Now let us consider together something which the Buddha constantly taught. You remember I mentioned yesterday that when a visitor came to him and he gave a graduated talk or a progressive talk, he spoke about giving, that is, generosity, dana, charity, use what word you like, about moral habit, about the vanity and the bondage which comes about through the pleasures of the senses. And when the visitor was moved sufficiently and, let us say, became asked for discipleship to train under the Buddha, he started him off with the discipline of the body. On the physical side, there was nothing specially mentioned as regards taking exercises or getting fit. Only abstemiousness where food was concerned. This is a very important point. Why do you think the holy ones did not talk about getting fit in our sense of the term? The more fit I become physically, I as I am, the greater becomes the conflict with urges, appetites, passions, desires, excitements, inner turmoil, and all the rest of it. It's a curious thing. To put it in its nicest form, we are like little children. If father is foolish enough to give me a Ming vase, within 5 minutes mother has to take a dustpan and brush and wipe up the fragments, collect up the fragments. Isn't that so? So that is seeing it in its kindest way. If we become fit, how do we use the body? Straight away. Indulgently. Oh, let's do this, let's do the other. And what's it all about? Pleasure. And what is the state of the mind? In the state of utter delusion that it is realizing happiness. Happiness cannot be chased, cannot be pursued, totally impossible. Pleasure can be chased. Sensational excitement can be chased, obtained, grasped, enjoyed, as we say, and then comes the bill to be paid, which is always heavier than what we can afford. Always. Happiness cannot be chased. It is part of my actual constitution. I can't chase that which is just me, myself. It is the condition of the healthy mind, the whole mind, the pure mind is happy. So you see, what happens when the body becomes fit is that because of its natural physical processes, its electrochemical activity, it produces that urge, that restlessness and disturbance in the mind, which makes one want to use this physical strength and well-being to obtain sensational delight for itself, the mind. This is the mistake. It misuses its assets. You see how hopelessly wrong is the approach of so many. They say, first let us lay the foundation of a healthy, strong body. Then we'll start developing the mind. Supposing the heart said, wait until the bloodstream has run through, then I will start pumping again. That will be the last thing the heart will ever say. Everything goes together as a whole. Interfere with the wholeness, and there is misery. So you see, the holy ones did not talk in terms of getting fit. They talked in terms of abstaining from all that obstructs true fitness. And that is the fitness of the whole being, is what they were wholly occupied with. What are some of the essential activities of the body as a body in relation to environment which contains people and which presents the situation in which any one person is? It's the senses, the sense organs. The sense organs are active all the time. We are looking at something, we are listening to something, we are touching something, etc. When we are doing anything with the body, the sense of touch is continuously active, is it not? Handling objects, moving about, all that necessitates the activity of the sense of touch, for instance. Now, how shall we use the senses? What is the art of using the senses? This formed one of the essential elements in what we call the disciplining of the body. It might be almost better to say disciplining by the body, because disciplining is learning. You learn the learning by the body, or the learning by the mind, or whatever it is. Now, with respect to all the senses and their activity, the Buddha clearly taught, let not the bhikkhu, when he sees an object, be entranced by its general appearance or the particular elements associated with it or composing it. Note carefully, be entranced. This is the key. Not to be entranced by it. He also taught complete and pure observation of it, not to miss out any point whatsoever. There is an enormous amount involved in all this. If we miss out some point or other, why do we do so? What is there in us which makes us do so? Supposing, for instance, I was brought up from childhood to be very modest. You see? So, I keep my eyes downwards, looking at the floor, at the ground. I don't look at a person completely and see the whole person. Or I was taught it is rude to stare and so forth. You see? Now what happens thereby? The natural process of the actual living body is, the natural tendency is to do the thing as a whole, completely. But upon that natural tendency is imposed this inhibition. You mustn't do this. Don't do this. Therefore, there is a repression of a natural function in its pure way. A conflict is set up deep in the subconscious. This must not be done. There's no true asceticism involved in that. And remember, the true asceticism, simply means that because you have clearly and fully seen that this is not necessary, it falls off. It's not in that way, but in the way of conflict that this is introduced into our life. Associated, let us take this question of looking at a person, for instance. A boy is brought up not to look at women or girls or whatever it is. See? You can see at once the roots, the seeds are sown for sexual repression and conflicts and all the rest of it. And in the same way, with respect to things, to persons and so forth. Mustn't look at it. What happens? Your natural powers for observation, for seeing, are inhibited. And if you don't see, and if all these seeds of conflict are present inside you, you reject that which is presented to your eyes. This, that, and the other. And if you are taught that you must look at this carefully because it is good, it is pure, it is whatnot and whatnot, then that is just a fixation. That this is the good, therefore I look at it. So you will compel yourself to look at it, thinking that by looking at it I am doing something which is good. See how the whole situation of unnaturalness is sown, of conflict. And therefore, whenever I see a person and meet a person, all this comes into play at once and prevents me from seeing the person. And when I'm prevented from seeing the person wholly, completely, what else is prevented? Transcendent love and understanding go by the wall. It's totally impossible for there to be true love, to be true, for there to be true understanding, true perception, when this terrible interference with the natural and full functioning of a sense takes place. I've said again and again, the senses and the sense functions are the cords of communion between ourselves and totality. What else is there? How does one first convey the message of love? The eyes of two people convey it to each other, don't they? And the way the eyes convey that message indicates the quality and nature of that love, doesn't it? You know the look of lust. You know the look of possessive passion. You know the look which is pure and beautiful, divine. You know it. I may be as bad a fellow as you like, but if another person looks at me with that divine purity, that perfect love, I will know it in spite of my devilishness. This is the peculiarity of the organism, of the living being. You know the truth. And you see how so much interferes with that truth. Now let us look. That is all this in connection with observe completely and clearly the whole fact. Let us look at that other statement. Let not the bhikkhu be entranced by the general appearance or the details thereof. What is the meaning of being entranced? Why does one get entranced? It's the play of all this conditioning plus the play of the repressed, what has now become possessive passion, etc., inside one. So one is entranced by it. Oh, there's a handsome fellow, and you are caught in it. Oh, there's a lovely girl, and immediately there's a wolf whistle. So, that which is truly beautiful is uglified. It's trampled into the mire. And can we solve these things by legislation? By committees? By royal commissions, by conference tables, by peace treaties? No. You can transform the world. You, the individual. You'll never see the transformation. You'll never know it. That is your happiness and your freedom, that you never know it. Because then you don't attach values to it. Don't start thinking foolish. Oh, this might have been better this way. Then that awful devil, the intellect, comes into play as the servant of desire, of preconception, and imposes his petty little thing upon the marvelous totality. That's why it's good that we don't know the good we do. The real good is the unconscious good. Your little baby is the most beautiful and wonderful thing in the world. This is perfectly true. When that beautiful and wonderful thing is born and grows up, it is beautiful, it doesn't know it. And in that, its beauty flowers. But then it is told once, twice, 10 times, 1,000, 1,000,000 times, "Oh, you little beautiful." And the little one begins to get conditioned. "Oh, I am the little beautiful, the little beautiful." How is it going to escape vanity? How is it going to escape, therefore, the situation and the possibility of looking at another and saying, "What has she got that I haven't?" You see? How right Puck was, "Lord, what fools these mortals be." And how wonderful was the genius of Shakespeare to make not a human being say it, but Puck, the non-human, the impartial observer of all humanity, the sprite. And there's the charm and the loveliness of it all. So, not to be entranced either by the general or by the details thereof, with respect to every sense function, but to use every sense function fully and clearly. Now, apply this, or rather, take it in the context of eating and drinking, of food. We know what the Buddha said about these things, about not being moved by desire for this food, that food, and so forth. When someone raised the topic with respect to himself, the Buddha himself, how does he eat? And he says, it's in the texts, you can see for yourself, "I observe the taste and the savor of the curry, of the rice, mindfully, completely, and I know that this curry and rice are of such and such a savor, a taste, a nature, etc. I observe and note all that completely. And when it is over, the whole thing is finished." There is no attachment to, "Oh, that was a jolly good curry, I'd like it again." There is no aversion to it, "Oh, that was an awful bit of rice." Nothing of the sort. No problem of the conflict of attachment aversion, of liking disliking, of accepting rejecting. But you see, all this is involved in what we commonly call our physical bodily life, isn't it? The discipline of the body, as far as holy living is concerned, as I suggested yesterday, involves the discipline of the total being. Just as in actual fact, the discipline of the mind also involves the discipline of the total being. Because remember, no body, no mind. And the other way around, no mind, no body. You may use any particular word, constitutive word, body, thing, object, mind, thought, feeling. Use any constitutive word, and that word has its full meaning, its full content, and its full significance only in the total, the whole reality. Awaken to this sense of wholeness, then. This is one of the deepest meanings of all discipline, all learning connected with the holy life. I feel there is something very essential for people like ourselves to develop. The art of conversation in which real deep consideration takes place. Bear in mind the meaning of the word to consider. From con, together with, and sidus, sideris, the Latin, a star. What is a star? It is a self-shining light, no borrowed light about it. It's a self-shining light. To consider really means to look deeply into the light, into truth, into reality. To consider together. Now, you know, in the old days, and this used to happen in a very remarkable way in medieval times in Western Europe, when the priests, the divines, had discussions. It was a process of mutual consideration. Something was said, a proposition was put forward, concisely, in as few words as possible, as lucidly as possible, the other person attended fully, took it all in, looked into it, considered it, and made a response. You see, this is conversation in the supreme sense of the term. This is one of the great faculties, the great arts, one of the great arts which the holy ones of the past cultivated. Because when there is such deep consideration, then there is a creative interchange. Then whatsoever one says has in it the element of enlightenment, of helping another in the true sense of the word, without any premeditation that, oh, I must help this person in this, that, or the other way. Because the response is a purely selfless response. There is no vested interest involved in it. There is no motive, petty motive involved in it. Every petty motive which is involved in a relationship between two people means that it contains within itself some element of dominating the other person. Usually wrapped up in that euphemistic form, I'm doing this just to help you, you know. So condescendingly said and felt. Now be very careful. I can't help you. That's nonsense. You can't help me desirously through premeditation. But you certainly will help me, whether you desire to do so or not, if I am prepared to receive it in the right way, as a learner. Then I am helped. And in that being helped, I have conferred upon you the dignity of helper. Just as if and when I learn from you, the dignity of teacher is conferred upon you naturally, inevitably. You have taught me. Now you see, this interchange between human beings takes place almost entirely in terms of words. What other interchange is there? The spoken word, the written word. It is the medium of this human communication at the level of the mind, the level of understanding. And the mind integrates all the sense functions and the sense faculties. Isn't that so? So you see how important this art of right conversation is. If one opens a meeting to discussion, what happens in the usual way? A person brings out a point. Usually a person with some considerable dominance in him. Not always. But usually it happens. Or some vested interest. I'm talking of discussions which take place in the world of things and affairs, not necessarily in groups like ours. And then there is a process of intellectual fencing. He has a particular viewpoint which he wants to push and get accepted. But this is fighting. This is conflict. People fool themselves that, what a good thing he did it, because, they'll find all sorts of reasons to see that it was a good thing. But if they look deeply enough into this good thing, they will see that the word good is simply associated with the non-frustration, to put it at its mildest, of so many particular desires, all of which are self-oriented. So many particular viewpoints, and so on. Again, self-oriented. So selfness and all its destructive aspect lies at the foundation of the whole procedure. This is ordinary discussion. What do we do, for example, in the universities where we meet and discuss things with each other? We sharpen each other's intellects. Of course we do. We become first-class intellectual fencers, verbal fencers, scoring points here, there and everywhere. What is the meaning of scoring points? opposing the other. This is not true interplay of mind and mind, whereas true conversation is an interplay of mind and mind. And the true interplay is a creative, healthy thing. You watch two youngsters who are real friends. They will say, let's have a little wrestle, friendly wrestle. And so long as it remains as a friendly wrestle, they are using their muscles and so on and developing skills of bodily movement and so forth, observation, coordination of eye and hand and limb and so forth, which is all very good. Just natural, healthy physical growth. But if and when any sort of selfness comes into play, oh, I'll down him, attitude, then it has failed in its purpose. You see, what this would imply in terms of the whole world and its affairs. Labour and Tory, TUC and government. The words of Puck come to mind again. But it is a fact. How can one introduce a little fresh air and a little light into this kind of atmosphere in the world, accepting that we ourselves know how to converse? So now, for the next 20 or 30 minutes, have a conversation now, all of you, amongst yourselves. Somebody say something, some point in connection with what we have been trying to look into and understand last night and this morning. Say something in that connection and let everyone consider carefully, and then a response, a real response, not a reaction, but a real response. You'll probably find it a bit difficult at first, a little awkward moving, but you'll soon be able to fall into the dance and make the right steps without treading upon the other person, your partner's toes.
This must involve and include everything, psyche, because whether the body, the way it was mentioned, includes the psyche as well, because it is a body, is nature, then the psyche is a part of nature, and then it really does not matter whether we say body or psyche.
It depends, doesn't it, a bit on who we're talking to. I think here, having heard Feroz, we could speak about the body and mean what he describes as the psychophysical organism, which means a lot. But outside here, when we say body, other people will think we mean something just the physical part without the psyche.
using the word is produces a suggestion. That is, if I use the word body, then I be conditioned. Well, simply the question is, what is the correct use? Should I use the word body? Should I use the word psyche? Or possibly the best is the psychophilic organism. And it is the question is important because when one uses one word or another, one expresses such or a different conception of what I am. If I say all I am a body, that's one conception. If I say all I am a psyche, that's another conception. If I say all I am a psychophysical organism, it's a third conception. Maybe it doesn't matter as long as one knows that, realizes that the words possibly do not matter. For example, there is this statement made by some Buddhists that there is a wisdom, there is a greater wisdom in the body than in the mind. Well, in this statement, this is probably the example of this view that I am essentially the body, and this body does not mean body, physical body, the way probably many people have in mind, but a body, all there is in me.
Could I perhaps ask you what you think is the definition of your own body?
Well, a psychophysical organism.
So that's someone else's definition. What's your translation of that definition?
May I perhaps say, what have you yourself found it to be in your own exploration, in your own discovering? What have you discovered for yourself that you, the person named Stanislav, what is that entity? What is that? How do you feel about it? Because after all, it's only a definition.
Yes, only a definition, but is it not so that there are these philosophies, for example, where the only reality is said to be the matter?
But could we get away from philosophers and philosophies and get down to the nitty-gritty of what we ourselves have discovered? Could you perhaps just perhaps think about that for a second?
Well, all I have discovered is that I am in. I'm aware of my thoughts, of my feelings, and of various sensations in my body. And this is probably why my view is that I'm a psychophysical organism.
Thank you.
But the question of body is to me more difficult than the question of mind or of a psyche. Because one can say that the being aware of my body is actually a mental operation. It's not a physical operation.
So you've discovered an important thing about it.
So, I mean, this would lead to the view that really there is no such thing as a body, because all I really know about the so-called body is through the eyes and the sense of hearing, possibly through the touch. But this introduces confusion, because one could say the touch itself is somehow has this character of being more bodily than mental.
You can't experience any sense without the mind interpreting it. So you still can't separate a touch from what you feel. You can't separate hearing from what you hear.
Wasn't that the point, to see it as a totality?
Pardon?
To see the whole thing as a totality. That, that you can't split off little bits of it.
You mean the whole, this whole thing?
Each one.
Then this whole thing.
Yes, each one influences the other, whether it's mind, body.
Yes, but there is. there is, for some reason, this is a crucial point, whether we are essentially a body or essentially a psyche.
Over the years, the Buddhist Society Summer School, an old gentleman who passed away last year or something, used to ask the same question every year. The question he kept asking was, what is mine? You see? Now, almost when he asked the question every year, and everyone tried to give him an answer, you see. Mr. Humphreys tried to give him an answer. Mr. Mehta tried to give him an answer. Everyone, every year, gave him an answer. But he still wasn't satisfied. He still kept on asking and asking. And the next year he wasn't there because he died. If you go around asking everyone what is sort of the body or what is the mind, are you going to recognise the truth when you hear it, or is it going to be just more words you're going to hear?
Probably more words, but it is there is this need of intellectually understanding one's position. I know that this is not the whole thing. Meditation and awareness is the important thing. But still, the intellectual understanding should help. Should be the finger pointing to the moon, pointing in the correct direction.
If you have a sort of a proper down to earth approach, like if you ask a doctor or a nurse what is the body, you know, I don't think they'd have any trouble giving you an answer. If you don't look for anything mystery or magical in the words you're looking for, it's not really difficult.
You know what the Japanese say about the finger pointing to the moon, don't you, Stanislav? You've got to keep your eye on the moon, not the finger.
Yes, well, but even in the awareness, there is this intellectual part of awareness, and suppose I'm aware of my foot being on the floor. Well, am I being aware of a physical phenomenon or of a mental? It's an interesting question, and it may not be a salvation of me, but it is relevant somehow.
Well, if somebody gives you a good pinch in your arm, what are you aware of?
A good what?
Pinch in your arm.
Oh,
someone
yes.
Pinches you really hard and brings tears to your eyes.
But the same problem for me, I don't know whether this is a physical or mental phenomenon.
But if you were dead, you wouldn't feel it. So it's the constituent in life which makes the body and the mind together. So the fact that you're alive and can feel pain brings us back to a psychophysical organism.
Also, what you were saying about doctors and nurses having no difficulty. In fact, they're discovering more and more that, for example, you can do a very good operation on somebody, but if they're frightened and nervous about the results, they will not recover anything like so fast as they would if you were able to set them mentally at rest. And it's astonishing the effect to which the mind does influence the body. Mm. Its recovery pattern and everything.
It seems to me that you are trying to make it an either-or thing, and this is what the intellect wants to do, to classify everything and to make dividing lines so that everything can be neatly arranged. Then we can form a mental picture of how it all works. But what we understand with the human intellect must necessarily be limited and finite and mortal. And we're not going to be able to form a mental picture of exactly how the totality of which we are part works. One has to obtain the consent of one's intellect to pursue a course of action which will take one beyond the intellect. So it seems to me you're trying to satisfy your intellect in that way. I think if you're going to do it in that way, you perhaps can anchor the psyche to the body, because it has a location in time and space that goes along with the body, doesn't it? But if you see our life as an experience of the relationship between the divine as form, as energy, as manifestation, which is the physical world, and the divine as consciousness, which is that which is within every person, then the psyche perhaps is the mediumship of this relationship, which is, our life is an experience of the relationship between the divine in these two in one. And the third thing perhaps is our experience, and there the psyche comes in. But you can anchor it to the body if you like, if you feel it has duration in and location in time and space. This might be a way of looking.
Psyche is the bridge.
But you can't say, in that case, you can't define it and say it's either or.
Yes.
But this is really very important, because if a doctor or a nurse thinks they understand what your body is and attempt to cure it, in a physiological way, then they fail. I was thinking, actually, it's rather a mundane question about eating and diet. People say, you know, that we are what we eat. It's very important to have a good balanced diet, lots of protein. And we seem to think that if we put this into children, they'll immediately grow up into perfect human beings. But it must be something to do with the way you eat it, and your approach to eating, and everything to do with life, before that food will nourish you as it should do. In the same way, it could be nourished perhaps with rather poor food if you approached it in a different way. You know, it's not as simple. I mean, I don't think you can do much to the body and ignore the psyche, or vice versa. I mean, can a person who's ill in the psyche be cured by ignoring the body? I don't know, I'm asking questions now.
So this is also bound up with this question of illusion. We are constantly, we are taught and we observe in ourselves the amount and various kinds of errors which we make. Well, then, so in this connection, I mean, I might ask the question, is the body a greater illusion than mind, or is the mind a greater than the body? Or is the splitting of the throne itself an illusion? Well, to me, this whole questioning is simply the restating of the question, who am I? I would like to know what I am. Am I mainly body, and after psyche, am I mainly psyche, and afterwards the body?
Isn't this something you have to answer for yourself, and and get a deeper insight as you go along? if you pin it down to an intellectual definition at any one point in time, you're stuck with that, and it's solidified, as it were. You have to keep doing this, surely. You have to keep asking yourself, who am I? And you might come up with different answers every
yes.
time.
Yes, but if there is an answer in intellectual terms to this question, if somebody says and gives me a proof, or I know that I have some other reason to think that he is pointing in the right direction, saying, forget about the body, look mainly in the direction of psyche, this is helpful.
Yes, but that will only be his answer, not yours.
Pardon? Yes, then I still have to do the main part of my search, but I know which direction to go.
Well, it may not be the right direction.
It may not be the right direction, no fear.
That's why I say intervening. And,
what?
Somebody else may give you a different answer.
But why do you have to be mainly one and mainly the other? Why is it necessary to be mainly one or mainly the other?
I don't know what it is. I'm saying suppose. I'm trying to justify my question. Our friend said that there was this gentleman who asked the question over and over again.
Isn't this something to do with our conditioning? Isn't this something to do with our conditioning, our culture, so in which we're brought up either to regard the soul and the body as totally separate, or we're brought up to consider that there is a material world and a material body and absolutely nothing else whatsoever? So if we have been brought up in this one culture where we have two things, a soul and a body, we separate the body from the soul and put them in opposition to each other. And if we've been brought up in a culture where we're not allowed to have anything except a material body, we find it difficult to visualize or feel that there could possibly be anything except what we can touch and analyze.
Well, this explains why I'm asking the question, but it doesn't give me the answer.
But aren't you looking for an authority to tell you the answer?
No, I'm willing to hear anybody saying anything because I'm interested in it. I can still ask the question even if I can put it out of my mind, whether somebody will give me the answer and I say, yes, thank you, that's not my problem.
If you don't mind me saying so, I seem to be the only person here that agrees with you. I seem to be the only person here that agrees with you. It seems to me that we are all living in a state of ignorance. Therefore, if we are able to dispel that ignorance, we are moving towards God. Now, if you are in a state of ignorance about your physical, your understanding of your body, of your mind, then to dispel that state of ignorance is a good thing for you. I don't see how this is too much of a problem. It doesn't seem to be to me anyway.
I wonder why it is we need a definition of ourselves. We seem to be lost without a definition. You know, I know an elephant when I see one, but I can't define one. But I still know it's an elephant. And do I need to define myself to know myself? I am me. I don't particularly want a definition.
No. All the time I'm trying to find out in which directions the fingers will be pointing. I know that I still have to to lift my head and look somewhere, or to use another analogy, I still have to go either there, north, south, or east, or west.
I don't think that's true.
This is the intellectual definition must only be the starting point.
I don't believe there is any direction. Why? But what must you go in any direction?
In order to fail.
Well, I mean, we are supposed to do some striving. I know that this is the forbidden word, but in any case, we are supposed to be doing something.
Does it matter what you do? Or what direction you go, as long as you make a step, and as Denpo there said, you might fail, but you have found something out about yourself, you just keep on going on.
If you chose a direction, if you chose a direction, wouldn't you limit yourself?
Well, I'm limiting, but has not Lord Buddha chosen a direction?
Yes, the direction is awareness.
He limits himself by choosing the direction at the start of his